from Social Service to SG. I am Jing Yao. What are the experiences of Singaporean academics who have spent time abroad before returning home and working to reintegrate, both as academics and as Singapore citizens? Together with our collaborators in the article International Academic or Citizen Scholar, Singaporean Returnees in the Global City, lead author Yasmin Ortega focused on this notion of reintegration as well as the conflicting demands associated with it. Like many others, I enjoyed reading the article, which we'll link in the show notes, and the conversation I had with her, as you'll hear, was a delight. Dr. Ortega is an assistant professor at Singapore Management University. Welcome to the podcast. Yes, man, I was really excited. I told you I was really excited to speak to you. But before we get into the paper, given the context of your paper we're about to discuss, right, I was really interested to hear first about your research interests and how you started your stint at the Singapore Management University as an academic, or SMU.
Okay, well, thank you so much for inviting me, Jin Yao. I'm really happy to be here. So I'm an assistant professor of sociology at Singapore Management University, and I like to see my work at the intersection of migration, higher education, and work, or in particular, this focus on skills and how we think about skills as valuable or something that drives our movement across borders. So, and I think that's probably because I come from the Philippines as well. So I myself am a migrant academic, and that's kind of driven my interest throughout the years.
Got you. And with that intersection between migration and higher education, I asked that question because the article we're talking about today, it's titled International Academic or Citizen Scholar, Singaporean Returnees in the Global City. And we'll link that in the show notes. But to start off, right, I love the abstract, I love the article, but to start us off, could I trouble you to read the following excerpt? And this is from the abstract, but let's start from the abstract and then let's walk through the article thereafter. Yeah.
Okay, sure. And thanks so much, by the way. I think it gives us so much pleasure to know people are reading our work and enjoying it, those two things. Okay, so the excerpt goes, "This paper reveals how spaces within the city can undermine the reintegration of former migrants seeking to reestablish themselves in their home countries. So based on in-depth interviews with 25 Singaporean academics, we discuss how the priorities of globally oriented universities can impact the reintegration of highly skilled returnees within their home city. Specifically, this paper reveals how returnees face the challenge of negotiating two conflicting demands upon the return home. As academics, they must adhere to the needs of their fast-changing universities, where pressures of world rankings demand global impact through research and publications. Yet, as Singaporean citizens, they also face expectations to fulfill the responsibilities of being home in their city, juggling calls for national service and community outreach among local university faculty."
And that's really nice. I mean, that's so clear. And when I read that, and I told you this as well in the community that we have, so many folks are discussing about that, right? But let's start from the title itself, because you set up this juxtaposition, international academic or citizen scholar, or your authors, and you set up this juxtaposition. So walk us through what the expectations are as related to you by your interviewees, that 25 Singaporean academics. What does it mean, or what are the expectations associated with being an international academic? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think how they talked about it is something that will sound very familiar to many of your listeners, probably, Jin Yao. This idea of having expertise that's recognized globally. And for them, it's the evidence of that is in your publications. So being able to publish in the top 10% of journals in the world. And of course, most of these journals are based in the West, right? For sociologists, it's journals like American Journal of Sociology. Yep. But that's seen as something with global impact. So basically being able to publish a significant number and to publish in the most prestigious outlets. That's how they had described international academic.
Yeah. And then on the flip side, with the prestigious publications racking them up, top 10%, all these considerations, what does it mean to be a Singaporean citizen scholar, that the identity that's juxtaposed against international academic?
Yeah, so it's interesting because here the definition becomes much broader. So on the one hand, it also involves some research, but basically research that has local relevance, right? So it could be a publication on Singapore that is on a salient topic locally. That's one. It could be a report or writing reports for local agencies or institutions. So it's still research, but it's not research that gets published in the top journals in your field. It can also be teaching, right? Being able to mentor students, especially local Singaporean students who are interested in pursuing careers in a range of fields. And it's also mostly service, right? So they describe a range of service. You could be asked to be part of a government task force on a specific topic. So I talked to someone who was in the field of public health, and he says that sometimes he gets called for like emergency task force on a certain hepatitis C outbreak or something like that. So it's a local service. It might be going to junior colleges to give career talks about the different careers that young Singaporeans can pursue. So here's where suddenly the task of the academic is much broader. And that's because the surrounding community or the country where this the city where these universities are based have different demands. And this is where your role as an academic can become much broader. The problem comes in when the university doesn't recognize all of that work or doesn't give it the same recognition as it would publishing in a top journal.
Yeah. And you're getting us there in that sense, right? Because clearly if it's in the title, you're setting us up for that juxtaposition. Help us understand that, or rather tease out that last point you made, right? Which is, what is that tension between being an international academic and citizen scholar, right? Is it about not having enough time or bandwidth to do both? Or is it that, as you mentioned, that if you do Singapore-based research, it's not international enough? You also mentioned just now for our listeners that a lot of the top journals are based in the West, right? Or the weird countries they call. And also you mentioned about service. So how would you summarize, what is it? What's that tension between international academic and citizen scholar?
Right. I think, Junyao, you hit the nail on the head. It is about time and bandwidth, because, of course, if you give time to one, you lose time for the other. If you write that report for the Ministry of Health, then you lose time that you could have spent writing a journal article for, like, I don't know, American Journal of Public Health, something like that. So there is that tension. But I think where it really becomes high stakes is that there is also another timeline that academics in Singapore have to follow. And not just Singaporean returnees, but all academics, right? And this, it's the tenure clock.
Yep.
So there is a limited time. You have 6 years or 6 to 8 years, depending on which institution you're from. And so as you're deciding how to allocate the limited time that you have on the tenure clock, then it becomes this choice of like, do I do more of this or that? But then what I'm hearing from my interviewees is that sometimes there's pressures to do both. And their claim, I don't know, some may disagree with this, is that if you're a Singaporean citizen, the pressure is to be a local scholar, a citizen scholar, is much stronger. It's harder to say no when the ministry asks you to do something. It's harder to say no when you're being asked to write a report that has national relevance. And so as they navigate this tension, some feel that they may not survive. They may not be able to produce enough at the end of their tenure clock. And so there's always this constant fear that eventually they may have to leave once again. And that's what I found so striking, Janiel, because I mean, I think of going home often, right? I wonder like, when's the time when I can go home to the Philippines?
Yeah.
And the tension there is so different.
Yeah.
The troubles we face is like, okay, how can I continue my research if the university has limited funding? Do universities care enough about international publications? So at home, the struggle is often the lack of a research culture that will recognize the need to publish in top journals. Whereas in Singapore, it's almost this opposite, that you can come home, you'll be given so much resources, you're in a world-class university, but then the fear is that you might eventually be forced to leave.
And I guess in kind of diving into the results further as well, and I would say as this next question
probably stems from the bias of me coming from the social sciences as well, right? Mm-hmm. When I was reading your piece, a few interesting dynamics, one of which is, did you observe or what were the differences between those in the more STEM disciplines or the more science disciplines versus those in social sciences, professional category, and the humanities, right? And this is where my bias comes in. When I read the article, I was like, the pressures of being a citizen scholar is not quite clear to me as a STEM scholar, right? Yes, you mentioned just now, they give a talk once in a while in a junior college or secondary school, right? And I love to be corrected on this. Whereas the examples you raise in for the humanities and social sciences, they're asked to comment on social issues. They're asked to attend that talk or there's an outbreak with the come in as well. So I love to be corrected, but you know, what were the differences between those STEM and non-STEM folks in the sample?
Yeah, I think definitely one limitation of my approach to this study was that I was definitely looking for themes that cut across both. I have a good friend and mentor, Andrew Mary Paul, who talks specifically about migrant academics within one field within STEM. So she looks at life sciences. Uh-huh. And she always makes this argument that each discipline is different. I completely agree. But in this paper, what it shows is definitely what academics seem to have in common across fields from social science to STEM. So I agree that perhaps social science folks might have to, you see them more in making these public commentaries, right? They may be, because it's social issues seem to demand much more from academics, you might think that, yeah, perhaps they have to do more than colleagues at STEM.
Yeah.
But actually, when I talk to the STEM colleagues, when they describe the type of work that they do as a citizen scholar, actually, it's quite a lot as well. So yes, these school trips are part of it, giving seminars, and that's every year they do that. They're often asked to be part of government committees on scholarships, disbursing scholarships. They might be asked to comment on certain like tech policies. And yeah, so it's often more behind the scenes, but it's still quite prevalent. So I think the pressures, there are certain pressures that cut across these different fields, although they take different forms.
Yeah, and that's a good point in calling out my bias, right? Which is just I'm not aware of it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. But as you listed it, that does make sense, right? Serving in committees and so on and so forth. So I think that's an important point that is raised in the article as well. I know you mentioned that it was the main driving force of the article was looking at similarities, but one another kind of point of probably departure or difference I was interested in when I was reading it was the perspectives between those who were on the tenure track and non-tenure track, right? You mentioned just now in explaining tenure clock is a six-year thing for listeners. They would be familiar, but that means if you get tenure, there's a certain set of privileges and benefits that come with it, right? But there are folks who you interview and who are in the system who are non-tenure track. So I guess the question here would be, were there perception differences between those who were on tenure track and those who are not on the tenure track?
Right. So I'm going to share some behind the scenes stories about this article. And I don't know if this is something that...
No, I'd love to hear that. Yeah.
Okay. So when we sent this article out for review, one of the reviewers did say that it seems you talk to tenured and tenure track folks.
Yeah.
Perhaps from the tenured interviewees, can you draw some, like, what were the things that they did right that made them get tenure? And that would be, I think I was being asked to identify what factors lead to successful reintegration of academics. And perhaps we can see it in these tenured interviewees because they did something different that made them successful. And the point I made is that it's impossible. You can't do that with this particular pool of interviewees. And that's because Singapore universities are constantly changing. So the tenured interviewees were those who were able to somehow ride a certain wave of change. So there were several interviewees who had been working in the university when they were corporatized in the 2000s, right?
Gotcha.
So
they
became autonomous. That led to this massive shift towards becoming an R1 universities. And they describe themselves as having survived that particular wave of change.
Yeah.
But then the university just keeps changing. The standards keep going up, the waves.
Yeah.
So what the tenure track folks are going through now is just another wave of change that my tenured interviewees have told me, I don't think I would have survived if I was on tenure track today. Right. There was one interviewee who said, I published in this journal. It's top three in my field, but I don't think I can publish there again, right? If I tried today, because of there's so much more competition. She said there's a data inflation. Now you have to do several more experiments just to prove your findings are actually good enough for that journal. And she said, it wasn't like that just 10 years ago. So I was telling the reviewer that I don't think we can identify like, ooh, what variables made these academics more successful than the juniors. Yeah. Actually, they're probably going through the same thing, but different. In fact, no, not maybe not the same thing. I think the tenure track interviewees of mine would say that the standards are much tougher today.
Yep.
Because the universities have gained a particular status, a global status that they have to live up to.
Yeah, no, that's a really important point, because I think the notion of an international academic maps onto one of the international university, right? And exactly what you mentioned, which is riding that wave of change, not just for the academics, but a lot of, I guess, what you described is probably also happening. I mean, it's not probably, it's definitely also happening in the US, right? Where the saying I've heard is what it used to be that you need for tenure is what you will submit as a tenure track position. And what you need for a tenure track position might be something you submit for a PhD application now, right? Like now, PhD aspirants who have 2, 3, 4, 5 publications, right? Which is the game has changed very unhealthily, I would say, from my personal opinion. And that's challenging for folks, I think. Yeah.
Right. I think so. I mean, definitely something I tried to emphasize in the article is that I'm not saying Singapore is unique. We're seeing this across different universities all over the world, especially very competitive universities.
Yeah.
But I think what makes it difficult for Singaporean returnees is that this is not just global city education hub. It's your home, right? You're coming home. And it's tough when, as an academic, you don't have a lot of institutions to choose from within this home of yours. And so if you don't make it in one, I think that's something I said in the article, if you don't make it to tenure, then either you leave academia or you leave your home. And I've followed up with a few, very few of the interviewees I had talked to, because when the article finally came out, I shared it with them and I said, hey, thanks so much. This was such a fun and important article to write. And some of them have left academia. They didn't make it. And some of them left home. So it was sad. It was sad to, as someone who's just looking in from the outside, I can't say I can completely understand everything of what it means to be a Singaporean academic, but I was quite struck by this dilemma to be in your field. So I really admire those of you, like you, Jin Yao.
Oh, no. That's such an interesting point, because I think this is the first time in our conversation that we've used the word returnees. And I think that leads to another question I had, and something you and your co-authors mentioned in the article. And this is something you highlight towards the end, and I just want to quote it. I'm going to quote verbatim. You're right. Interviews themselves also pointed out that our study did not include other Singaporean returnees who eventually left the country or no longer work in academia, which is what you just mentioned, even beyond the scope of the study. And in many ways, this topic became an important point of reflection that reinforced our later arguments about the factors that shape their return home, right? So I'm thinking of it from this is the end of the quote, and I'm thinking of it from a lens of like a selection bias problem. But you know, beyond that concern, how do you think the topic reinforced your paper's arguments, right? That maybe you are speaking to those who made it, but not speaking to those who quote unquote did not make it in that narrow definition of getting tenure and being in academia.
I think about it often. So it was something I was very aware of, that wow, we're only talking to people who are still here, right? And I guess to just flesh out this worry of mine, I was worried that we weren't talking to people who decided not to come back. Right. And then we weren't talking to people who left voluntarily. So I was thinking that there could be many reasons why people might choose to leave Singapore. And not all of it has to do with this tenure race or having to prove yourself to the university. But at the same time, I think what I found striking was in talking to people only in Singapore, we really had a sample of folks who wanted to stay. That was And so these were those who remained. They're determined to stay, and they're constantly worried about having to leave later on. And I think that's where the findings, I think, really emphasize the difficulty. The fact that we're talking to a selected sample of people who really want to stay and they're still anxious goes to show that these pressures must be really, they must be really feeling it. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think something I picked up through all your quotes as well is the personal matters a lot. So professional considerations was the key thrust of the article. And I think that's really well done. I think the other part that was like the underlying kind of theme that runs through a lot of interviews that I read in the paper was about the personal, right? It's about being close to family. It's about starting a family. And then I'm thinking about conversations that folks will have about getting a flat and all these things, not in the article, but you know, it gels kind of nicely with, and I guess the reason why it resonates with a lot of the folks also, so that came up. I guess one last question, right? It's not something that's alluded to in the paper. It's just something that since you work in migration and higher education, I thought would be interesting. Maybe it came up during the interview. The question would be, were there discussions centered on this notion of we pride ourselves in saying Singaporean universities are top tier universities, international, but a lot of Singaporean scholars choose not to do their PhDs in Singapore, right? They choose to, myself included, we chose to go overseas, which is a bit of weird thing you'll see from the outside. If it's global, then we should be doing the PhDs in local universities, right? Rather than doing overseas. So I guess it's not something that was alluded to. So kind of like an unfair question, but I just want to put that out as a final kind of like open question to you.
No, that's a great question. And actually, a colleague of mine who graduated from a local university, that's the first thing he said to me when we saw each other again. He was like, I read your article and you don't talk about local graduates. And I'm like, yes, you're right. Yeah. Yeah. So I think it is an interesting dilemma. And again, as an outsider observing it, I find it so interesting that Singapore has built up this global reputation and it's put the same global standards on its faculty. And we just talked about all of the possible issues that come out from that by insisting on global standards. But then when it comes to education or teaching, it's almost as if working within it as in a Singaporean institution, I think we ourselves don't expect Singaporeans to come and study their PhD with us. As a faculty member, I think it's almost taken for granted that Singaporeans will probably go overseas. And I don't know if this is all part of, Elaine Ho talks about how Singapore citizenship is built on this idea of being globally oriented, but locally rooted.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's fascinating. In a sense, the academia within the country thrives on this idea that local citizens like you will go overseas, gain this wonderful experience, but then come back and be locally rooted. And I guess our paper is showing that, that's not occurring as smoothly as we thought. Those who leave might not come back, but those that do feel like they might not be good enough. I have a good friend who I've been convincing to come back. I said, we have an opening. Would you like to apply? She's in Australia now and she's afraid. Like she said, I don't want to come back and then have to leave again if I don't make it.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting worry to have as a returnee. Because if you look at the literature on migration, return migration, often they describe it as a conflict between living overseas for so long, then coming back and feeling out of place, right? So it's always a tension between the country, the former host country, and your home country that may not feel like home anymore. That did not come out at all in any of my interviews. That I think that's what shocked me as a migration scholar. Singaporean academics just talk about trying to stay at home. And it's not necessarily adjusting to Singapore society, but just surviving the Singapore university.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think this idea of local graduates, Singaporeans not going to local universities and graduates of local universities not being given as much status or prestige. Yeah. I think that might be all part of this uneasy tension between trying to be global and local at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree and resonate. I think another big reason why I think the paper resonated is because there's so much you want to see in the paper as well, but there's so much more that folks can build upon, right? The questions that you raised in terms of returnees based on, it depends on which schools you, which country you are in, which school you got your PhD in, that determines how the extent to which you can return, right? Coming back, that notion between home and host countries, how tethered you are to the local, to Singapore, and the tension, I think, with the local and global, it's almost like an extension of the Singapore education system as well, because you will also see this in how government scholarships are given lower down the tier, not just for PhDs, but really for how the civil services staff, right? Many of them who are scholars were educated overseas, not in the local universities in that sense. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting piece that brings up so many questions, and I really enjoy reading it and talking to you about it.
Thank you so much. That means a lot. I mean, if I could share just one last thing, for especially for any of your listeners who are writing journal articles, I know we have a lot of pressure to be very theoretical and very, I don't know, the more abstract, the better. I don't know. Or maybe that's just sociology. But there is a lot of meaning in writing people's stories in a way that speaks to the literature, but also speaks to readers. To write a piece that resonates with folks is a big achievement for me. And so I had, as I said earlier, reached out to some former interviewees. So one of them landed on his feet, but he didn't get tenure. So he left academia. And then he said that, well, thanks, Yasmin, because at least you documented my words for that period of my life. And I was like, oh, this is the best review ever of my work. And so, yeah, it means a lot. And I think being part of this podcast also means a lot to me, because it feels nice to write people's stories in a way that resonate with others.
Thank you. And thank you for being on. Again, for listeners, we will link the article in the show notes. I highly encourage folks to read it and then send your questions and discussions as well. For us, it's been really enlightening, and I thank you for your time today. And then hopefully we will be able to build upon and expand the discourse around Singaporean returnees in the context of the universities we have in Singapore. So thank you, Yasmin. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.